It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer from Bleacher Report. It is Kobe Day, 8/24. If you're not familiar with that, you should not need this explained, but August 24th, those are Kobe's jersey numbers, 8 and 24. And if it weren't official, it did become official. LA County made it an official day in 2016, Orange County as well. This is officially Kobe Bryant Day. This is also, of course, the day after what would have been his 42nd birthday. We're also in the midst of the NBA playoffs, of course. We're in the midst of the presidential party conventions. And if you're wondering what all of that has to do with each other, I've got it for you, folks. I have found the nexus between Kobe Bryant, the NBA playoffs, and the presidential conventions. That nexus has a name. His name is Brandon Gassaway, who you may have encountered on Twitter as Kobe Stan. And if you haven't, go look him up. He's the National Press Secretary for the Democratic National Committee. And as you might guess by the Twitter handle, a huge, huge Kobe and Laker fan. And somebody I just was really looking forward to having this conversation with about all of the above. Brandon, welcome.
So I've wanted to do this for quite some time. What up, Beck?
What up, man?
Yeah, that's a Kobe line, right?
That's a Kobe line, yeah. God, yeah. You know, it's funny because Zach Lowe has been using that for me so long now, I sometimes lose track of it. It has become almost just an NBA Twitter thing or an NBA. And I'm always flattered by it. It's fun when people bring it up. And it wasn't until Kobe passed in January that I really was thinking about everything and that day and that week and just coming back to, yeah, that's due to him. Kobe's the one who first said, "What up, Beck," which I didn't even process at the time, but Zach did. Back in 2011 during the lockout when Kobe said it. And yeah, it's become a thing. And now I'm really glad it's become a thing because I have that tie to Kobe, you know, forever. It's still, by the way, so weird. Here we are in August. It was the 26th of January. So we are almost exactly 8 months.
Yeah, it kicked off this hellscape of a year.
Yes.
And it's like one of the first things that I remember about 2020, unfortunately, is that day, that morning. And it still kind of sticks with me because, you know, it caught me completely off guard. My TV wasn't on. One of my best friends from high school actually called because I've been, you know, diehard Kobe guy since I can remember. So like my high school buddies called me and were like, "Oh, I'm sorry." And I had no idea. And had to look it up, and it was awful. And it still is awful. But you know, something that I take from the Mamba and everything is that, you know, you got to press forward, you got to be better every day and not let things get you down and take you out of your rhythm. So, you know, that helps me press forward, but it's still a big loss, not just in sports, but you know, in every facet of life.
Absolutely. And still surreal. It still doesn't feel like even somebody sent me a clip today from BR. Somebody came across a clip where Kobe had sat down with some of our video folks to do something. And one of them mentioned, "Hey, Howard Beck says hi." And it's Kobe responding, saying, "Oh, how," you know, referred to me as Howie in that one. And like, you know, saying something about like, "Oh, Howie, my guy, da, da, da," whatever. And like, it just hit me again. Like, oh my God, like he's not, I still can't believe he's not here. It still doesn't make sense. And in a surreal, messed up year where so many things are wrong, and that was early on in all this sequence of events, it still doesn't make sense. It still doesn't feel like that happened. And I have to kind of remind myself constantly, like you look at every shot of him and he just looks like so young and vibrant and, you know, ambitious as he ever was, attacking the world of media and entertainment and everything. And it still doesn't make sense to me. It still doesn't feel real. I don't know that wherever all of us, you know, whatever the association was, is it's ever going to feel right. You're sitting there in a room where, I'll describe it. I've put up a photo on Twitter of the two of us chatting here. But you've got Kobe up above, over your left shoulder, celebrating the 2010 championship. Yes,
that's correct. Over the hated Boston Celtics.
Yes. And you've got the Mamba Mentality book down there too. So you work in politics at a high level there for the Democratic Party. And this is a really, obviously a huge moment and a huge time for this country, period. We'll get into that.
Say the least.
But we'll get to that. But how does somebody, because I think that this is a really interesting line to draw here, how does somebody go from like incredibly passionate Kobe fan and that how that passion for you drives you and takes you on the path that it does to where you're, you know, national press secretary for the Democratic National Committee in one of the most important moments in our country's history? Because I know there is a nexus there.
Yeah. So basketball was the first thing I ever fell in love with. Basketball was everything until from about 7 years old when I got my first ball and my first hoop, all the way up through the rest of my life. But what, and I grew up in New Orleans, but I was actually born in Los Angeles, and my mom moved back home to New Orleans when I was really young, 2 or 3 years old. But she always had me in like Magic Johnson baby clothes and was a big Showtime fan. So Laker stuff was always around. So that's what I associated with basketball as a very little kid. And once I finally started getting awareness of my own, it was really the beginning of the Kobe era. So that I had my guy, you know, I had my sport, and I put those two things together. And it was just fandom at first. Like, you know, there was 2000, 2001, 2002, which you're intimately familiar with. And us not having a team in New Orleans, I could be full on Laker fan. And then by the time we did get a team, like, the ship had already sailed. Yeah. But in 2005 was Hurricane Katrina, and I ended up moving back to the LA area to stay with family and things like that. And it was a really dark, empty time in my life. And this was the same time, this was running around with Smush Parker. And like sort of the only structure I had in my day is I got to watch the Laker game. And now that I'm in LA, I get every Laker game. So it's one of the things I threw myself into, and seeing, you know, the Lakers at that time, that was the first time I ever seen the Lakers be bad. But we still got to push through is the Kobe mentality. Like, if I got to get 40, well, I'll get 40. If I got to get 50, I'll get 50. If I got to get 80 to win, I'll get 80. Push, get better every day, commit to your craft. Because you have a job to do at the end of the day, no matter what is pressing on you, no matter what the adversity is, you have a job to do. And if you want to be the best, you have to commit to it fully. And that's the seed of the Mamba mentality planted. And to see him go out there for the rest of his career, you know, no matter if it was on one leg, three fingers, or I got to shoot left-handed, that commitment to get it done, that commitment to your craft to be the best, was inspiring to me. And it's something I took when I finally figured out what my professional path is going to be. I have to attack that in that same way in order to be successful, in order to achieve and get to the places I want to go with it. That is the type of mentality I have to have. And if that's, you know, waking up at 4 and going to bed at 2, you know, so I get all the reading done I need to get done, so I get all the research done and all the prep and all the and everything that it takes to succeed. When the lights are on, I'm going to do those things because that's the Mamba mentality.
Yeah. Do you remember when it first caught? Like, was it a specific game? Like, when does it go from just being Laker fan to like, this is my guy and it's because of that? Was it a one play, one game, one moment?
Well, the one game that sticks out the most is the game where he's got, I think it was a twisted ankle, and Shaq fouls out.
And against the Pacers?
Yeah. And like, this thing is on you. Like, what you got, young fella? Like, it's your time. This thing is on you. Can you meet the moment? Can you show up? And when he did that, I saw it as like, how do you do that? How are you prepared for that when, you know, you've always had Shaq to... You know, I always have this margin of error because I have the most dominant force on my team. But when your moment is called, are you ready for it? And when I saw that happen and then later heard from him what it takes to get there, that's really the moment that sticks out most in my head.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me, having covered that, obviously. So this is for people who don't know, 2000 NBA Finals, Game 4 against the Pacers. Kobe turns his ankle in Game 2 so badly. And this is Jalen Rose, who has in later years admitted that he kind of did it on purpose. So he wasn't trying to like injure him badly, but he kind of wanted to at least hurt him a little bit, slow him up. So Jalen gets under Kobe. Kobe twists his ankle really badly, misses Game 3. And there's not even a certainty that he's going to play Game 4. And this series could have gotten away from them. That he played Game 4 at all was surprising to, I think, almost all of us. And then, yes, having to take over after Shaq fouls out and win it in overtime, including with this like tremendous reverse put back of a Brian Shaw miss. Like, it's just, it's phenomenal. People go look it up if you haven't seen it. So, like, I love that, Brandon, I love that that is that your moment. Like where it cinched your fandom of Kobe, but also the admiration of what he, because that is it with Kobe. It's not just that he was like dazzling or charismatic or as a player. And the aggression, there's all these other traits of his that stand out, but the perseverance is a really big thing. And that was an early sign. And at that time too, again, for people who were young enough or too young to know this, in 2000, which is like, so this is like the end of his fourth season or whatever.
Yeah.
He's a star, but he's more of a celebrity than an NBA star at that point. People are like, you could see it's coming. He's had plenty of moments. It's coming. But all the Michael talk was not validated until that moment. That was the moment where everybody said, oh, I see it now. This kid's not, it's more than just hype.
Yeah. And for Hoop fans and us Kobe fans specifically, I think a lot of us have this, deeper connection because we spent a lot of time defending him. Like, Vince Carter was the dunker, AI had the handles, like, you know, T-Mac had this silky smooth game, and Kobe was just work. Like, let's go get it, let's go after you. Supremely talented, yes, but, you know, sort of the marquee skill sets were other guys around the league, and he really had to compete with those other swingmen with, you know, who had the popular opinion or who won the room. And I remember engaging in a lot of those debates all through high school. and just say, look at Kobe's numbers compared to all of those guys. You could dribble at the top of the key as much as you want to, but when the game's on the line, I want the ball in 8's hands and later 24.
Yeah. Are you an 8 guy or a 24 guy at your core? Like, which one? I know you've got jerseys. How many jerseys and how many are 8s and how many are 24s?
I have 6 jerseys. I have 4 8s and 2 24s, which has my allegiance. 8 is definitely my allegiance. I had the mini fro in high school and the whole deal because I like the up and coming nature of it. Just the hunger, you know, the flashiness, the cockiness. I really like that era of his game. So it's still my personal favorite, but you know, the whole career, he's got 2 jerseys in the rafters for a reason. Like, the whole career is spectacular.
Yeah. And as people have pointed out, you could create it. You could contextualize a Hall of Fame career for either one, both 8 and 24, which is why it's justified to retire them both, because there was almost two distinct eras and versions of Kobe, and both were spectacular in their own right and had their own stats behind them, championships behind them, all the other honors, which again is I think it's a pretty rare thing. And, you know, I think there were more than 2 Kobes. There was only 2 jerseys, but like, I think you could go through, there were many stages across those 20 years. But yeah, I'm an 8 guy too, because, and I say this not as a fan, but of course as somebody who covered him, but my bias is I covered those years. I was up close for 97 to 04. So for me, like, that's the Kobe I knew, was the one who was just struggling to find himself, right? Like, I'm the youngest guy here. I got to struggle to find myself in the locker room, in the pecking order. How does Shaq and I coexist? Who am I as a player? Who am I as a person? Like, the growth part of Kobe, like those evolutionary years to me were, you know, the most fascinating. And yeah, in part because I was there, but in part because I just think, I don't know, I think that part of his story was fascinating. And I think also the 24 years, the Mamba years, you know, like, he was never the Mamba to me, because that nickname came later. And I also just, you know, there were times there was excess there. Like, you know, that was Kobe on hyperdrive. And it's not that he didn't, like, you know, go over the line sometimes when he had to play with Shaq too, but they would find that balance at the right times when he didn't have a Shaq to kind of almost keep him honest in a way, right? So that's when you get 81 points. And again, granted, it's because you
played
with Smush.
Well, 81 was in number 8.
Oh, that was it. You're right. So it was like the season before
against Toronto. Yeah,
he was transitioning to the Mamba at that point.
Yeah, that was the transition point for sure. So when you say there's three or four, that's probably the second or third one.
Yeah, and the reason I draw that distinction in part of my own head is because I'd already left by that point. So I like if only I could have hung on for like maybe one more year, I could have seen 81. But I was already in New York covering the Knicks for the Times, and so I sometimes make the dividing line when I left. But you're right, the 824 line is a year after that, I think it's 05. So your Kobe, so at some point there, you know, like this is your guy because of all the things he represented to you. You texted me on the day that Kobe died saying, you know, just how much obviously you were hurting. And your text to me said, I tried to model my work ethic after Kobe, literally the reason I love basketball. When did it become like a conscious thing for you, Brandon, to say like, all right, I know what I want to do. I know I want to work in politics. And I know that the best way to do it is to follow the lead of this superstar athlete that I love, that you can apply, that the lessons of Kobe could apply to everything. And you like, how did you know to apply those? How did it manifest itself?
So that time was college. Like I mentioned before, like I moved to LA under pretty dire circumstances. Like my house had 8 feet of water for 2 weeks, left with nothing and kind of out there in the world floundering. But after I got to college and sort of got my feet under myself, I was still really disconnected from politics at the time. I had felt failed by the local government, the state government, the national government, and wanted nothing to do with any of it. So that's why when I hear that now, I sort of sympathize with people because I've been in that place. But what changed for me is in 2008, this guy from Chicago said, if you don't like your government, you can change it. And that lit a fire under me to saying, okay, here are all the things I hate about the government and how I feel left behind. But if we can get this guy, maybe there's someone listening to me and help me and I can change those things. So I volunteered, I became an intern, I did those things. And you see the level of work it takes to be successful in politics, especially during campaign season. It's really 24/7 because you have to be prepared to react to everything as it happens in a thoughtful and nuanced way. So when I got in that environment, I saw, okay, I need to step up my level of work if I'm going to be successful in this arena. And my model throughout my whole life, my model of hard work was Kobe. So I started, you know, listening to everything he had said about things that was written about him, about what his commitment level is to be the best. And I would try to mirror those things, you know, oh, he says he's at the gym at 4 a.m. Well, I need to be reading the paper by then. He's, you know, takes little brow, bring my kids to school and, you know, I'm right back at it. Well, I can go to class and then get right back at it and study what's going on. And like, whether that's, you know, following what happened in Congress that day or following, you know, what candidates are up and coming or what the vote totals are in certain precincts and, you know, where can we increase turnout to make a difference in elections and those things. So like where he was practicing and taking 1,000 jump shots a day and doing those things, I would try to translate that to what would make me more effective in my career. And it's so far worked out for me so far. There's an old saying that you know, when you're black in a space that's mostly white, is you have to work twice as hard for half as much. And the Mamba mentality really makes that a way of life to where you keep that drive to continue working hard every day.
That makes a lot of sense. And so you started in 08 then. Were you volunteering on the Obama campaign?
Yeah, I was still in college. did not devote as much time to my studies as I did to the campaign, but it was successful for us. And I was in school in LA. So a lot of the work was, you know, if you can make it out to Nevada for a weekend and things like that, and making phone calls into different battleground states. But that's when I first got my real taste of it and really, really figured out that this is what I want to do.
So how does one go from college student volunteering on the Obama campaign to 12 years later being a national press secretary for the DNC?
It is a very long and winding road, but you know, I went from an intern, and one thing I always tell people who want to work in politics and want to make a career out of this is, no matter what your role is, if you kick ass in that role, people are going to see you and want you for the next campaign or the next opportunity, because hard work is the currency. So from that, you know, volunteer effort on the Obama campaign, I got an opportunity in the 2010 midterms after I graduated, working for the whole Democratic slate for the state party. Among those, a young woman running for attorney general by the name of Kamala Harris, you know, another woman who was running for Congress for the first time, Karen Bass, including a guy running for lieutenant governor, Gavin Newsom, and a long list of folks on a slate was my very, very first race. Wow. After that, I did a bunch of smaller races, city council, local stuff, and hit a point to, you know, if you're an athlete, you want to go to the pros. You want to make the league. And the league in politics is DC. So as much as I love Southern California and want to get back there as much as possible, I knew if I was going to maximize my opportunity in politics, that DC would have to be the place I would go. So I packed up, I moved with no job prospects, no certain thing lined up. But I went here, I set up at the Longworth office building, which is one of the office buildings connected to Congress, in the cafeteria every day, and got on LinkedIn and sent out emails and cold calls and applied for jobs during the day and waited tables and bartended at night. Wow. Until I got an opportunity with my hometown congressman, Cedric Richmond from New Orleans, to said, "Hey, I need a press secretary. Do you know how to do that?" And of course, I'm like, "Hell yeah, I know how to do that." Because, you know, what will Kobe say if you can you do that? Can you pull that off? So I said, "Hell yeah, I could be a press secretary." And I got an opportunity there that led. It was one of my favorite jobs I ever had. One of my favorite things about that job is it was the one time in my career that I've been surrounded by other basketball fans as big as me. The guys from that office, the Louisiana 2nd District office, we're still in a group text today that nightly is an NBA focus group text when it's folks that are, you know, at varying levels and branches of government, but basketball is the thing that still unites us all. But from that job, we went to 2016. I joined the Hillary campaign in Virginia, still the only campaign I ever lost. It feels like the 09, not 09, the 08 finals to me. It just bothers me endlessly that I still lost that race. And I won't get into it because I try not to relive it, but
no, nobody wants to relive it
that day. But because I was based in Virginia, I got a lot of interaction and work with Senator Tim Kaine's team. Mm-hmm. And he was up for re-election in 2018, that very next cycle. So as I said before, if you do good work in your opportunity, another opportunity will come.
Yeah.
So I got an opportunity with Senator Kaine's office. We ran in Virginia last cycle, won by about 20 points. So it was a good way to get off the snide. And Tim Kaine, being a former DNC chair, when the DNC was looking for help on their communications team, I got a recommendation from his office. And here I am trying to avenge that loss, much like Kobe and the Lakers did in 2010.
I like it. That's a great analogy. See, folks, basketball, it's universal. It applies to everything. You can always find the connection. All roads lead back to the NBA and or Kobe. I love that. So, by the way, she won by 3 million votes. So it's a loss. Yes, it goes down in your personal loss column, Brandon. But like, that's an asterisk season. That's like, yeah, there's Paul, if there ever was Paul an Pierce, asterisk.
And Paul Pierce didn't need a wheelchair to get off the floor either. But you know, I digress.
Fair. There's a twisted analogy to 2016 in the election there that I don't know how we'd get there. So I'm going to leave that one alone. I love the career path, and I love the fact that it also starts with somebody, Obama, saying, you know, that look, if you don't like the way things are going, you know, you got to work to change them. So you've got another pillar there of you know, in terms of your inspirations to kind of take the path you're on. But I'm curious about the thought, and this could be a 3-hour discussion on its own. But let's do the short version of it. People are very cynical about politics, understandably so. Maybe even more now so than ever for various reasons. And I think it's hard to, and this even comes down to voting, right? You still hear it now, especially when people were disappointed because their candidate didn't emerge from the primaries. And so then it's this feeling of despair or helplessness, and you can't do anything about it. And so now the message has to always be, hey, listen, at a minimum, you got to vote. And people don't even know that they don't even feel like voting matters sometimes. Obviously, it does. It's incredibly important. But there's more than just that. I'm curious for you, as somebody who, you know, you go through, you know, personal and family devastation, and you see when government can fail us from that, because of the words of President Obama, you decide, no, I want to be the change that I want to see. Right. So now you've been living that for a while. Has it changed the way you feel? Because I think being in that political bubble can also make you more cynical, because you see how the sausage is made and how difficult and that world can be. So do you find that this has been a constructive way to channel it, where you feel more faith in the system, or how has it evolved?
So I wouldn't say I've become more cynical, but I've realized that nothing in politics and government happens by accident. All these things are intentional because someone wanted them to happen, and those someone are the people who voted for the people who are making these decisions. The other side, and I don't want to get too political, because I know I know the medium I'm on, but you know, the other side runs against us saying government is broken, wins, breaks it more, and say, look how broken government is. Because they earn the votes of people who believe that the government is broken. So they're delivering to them what they want to see. Now, that discourages the people who want government to work, because they hear these people saying it's broken. And they have all these things in their lives that confirm that. That when you look at the post office, that it's being intentionally broken, so he can then go say, it's broken, we can't use it for voting. So it's really hardened my belief that if you get enough votes, if you get enough people behind a cause, behind an idea, you can make meaningful change, and you can make meaningful differences inside our government. Now, politics, for in the House, it's every 2 years. In the presidential level, it's every 4. And it's the same to increments in the states and on the local level. So the progress you do make, if you don't stay consistent, it could all get rolled back. All the great things we did with Obama in power, he's rolled a lot of them back, and the Affordable Care Act's hanging on by a thread. You know, they're actively in court now trying to invalidate it in the midst of a pandemic. So it goes to show that, you know, I understand why people are cynical. I understand why people are, you know, disappointed or have lost trust in their government. But the people who have done that want you to feel that way so they can keep doing what they want to do.
But it has not put a damper on obviously your belief that you can affect positive change, and that working from the inside, that, you know, it seems like that's what gives you hope, that you can see where the path back to a functioning country is. And you're working every day for it. So last week, the Democratic National Convention, obviously very unique. Like I said on Twitter, like, I'm not sure what's stranger, like the virtual Democratic Convention or the virtual NBA games, because in both cases, it's like, there's just, you're missing this ambiance and the interactivity of it, of, you know, whether it's the candidate hitting their applause lines and there's just no, you don't feel it, or whether it's, you know, Dame Lillard hitting like an insane shot, or Luka the other night. There's not that sonic boom that comes behind it, right? And in both cases. And so it just underscores in all of, you know, my world, yours, everything is a little strange. But we also did have yet another connection, NBA to politics, last week, because you guys had Steph Curry virtually weighing in. Can you give some insight into how that comes about? And also, I'm curious, like, in this time when people are kind of just crushing that wall that maybe never existed but kind of did between professional sports and politics, how important is it, do you think, to, whether it's the Biden campaign, Biden-Harris campaign, or Democratic politics period, that you've got Steph involved like that, that you've got LeBron and his More Than a Vote efforts? Where does that fit into the bigger picture?
It's incredibly helpful. Steph is, first of all, a very thoughtful guy, cares a lot about his family and cares a lot about his country. And he's had run-ins with this president before, and has made it very clear that this is not the direction he wants to see the country go in, and has come on board, which we're very thankful for, which has been very helpful for us. And what that does is it brings folks in that maybe otherwise would not have engaged with, whether it's the convention, whether it's how to vote, whether it's even what's going on a day-to-day basis, how this election will make a difference in your life. So what that does is broadens our pool of people that we can potentially contact or touch and say, hey, here's the stakes on November 3rd for you personally. Now, you can make whatever decision you want with that information. We're going to give you the tools to go vote and to go make your voice heard and do everything it is you want to do. But, you know, without someone like Steph and without someone like LeBron, and I think we'll get in a little more to what LeBron is doing a little bit later, but that creates, you know, one extra person. And if we get one more person to register, one more person to vote, one more person to write a letter to their congressman, one more person to run for office, our democracy is that much better.
And, you know, the players at their level, because they are role models, because they're celebrities, because they're inspiring to younger people, there's that effect. Then there's also just the NBA institutionally right now, where so many of these teams have decided to open up their arenas as voting precincts. So there's that. It's a, you know, kind of a parallel, separate, but equally important level here, right? Where you've got players who are working on a grassroots level or just working to set a tone. And you've got teams and some team owners that have really stepped up by making their buildings available at a time when we really need socially distanced areas and massive buildings to be able to vote, because the ability to vote at all is under threat.
Yeah, and I just want to underscore that what they're doing at More Than a Vote is nothing short of amazing. It's not just talk. It's not just one election. They are building infrastructure that's going to last a really, really, really long time. So when you look at these arenas are going to serve as voting centers in communities that are being most impacted by the coronavirus, and that their votes are by far the most threatened, and they have the most reason to be fearful for their health and safety by going out to vote, and providing them a space where you can social distance to go exercise that right is critical. But beyond that, if you look at the cities that have been rolled out, Atlanta, Charlotte, Detroit, you know, we were just in Milwaukee. Milwaukee's very interested in being a voting center as well. These are cities that are going to be extremely critical in the election. And these are all swing states and all very big voting populations within swing states. And then to go a layer deeper than that, what they're doing in Florida to pay off these taxes and fines. So what Florida did is the voters overwhelmingly voted to restore voting rights to former folks who have been convicted in Florida. But what the callous Republican legislature did was, oh, you have your rights back, but you need to pay back all these fees, court fees or whatever the case may be, before you can vote. Now, we're fighting that in court because that's effectively a poll tax.
Yes.
But what More Than a Vote and LeBron has stepped up and done is they have started paying off those fines themselves, because the litigation route is a very long and cumbersome route. And there's no guarantee that we would get a favorable decision before Election Day, or even in enough time, even if it's before Election Day, enough time to get all these folks reinstated on the rolls and registered and all those good things. So they're just paying them off. So all these folks will be eligible by the time November is coming around. So this is really critical work they're doing. It's not just charitable, it's strategic, and it's going to have a big impact, not just in this election, but going forward.
And by the way, Brandon, it also underscores, and again, I always look for this, for the pushback against those who want to cynically dismiss this as, you know, symbolism, or just, you know, oh, somebody fired off a tweet, somebody issued a statement, whatever, you know, what's LeBron really doing? What's Steph Curry really? Well, a lot, actually, and in LeBron's case, especially with the More Than a Vote campaign, like this is not just sending out press releases. This is not just tweets. This is not just calling Trump a bum on Twitter, even though that has its own great value. There's fundamental work being done here that is incredibly important.
And they brought in people who, like, from my world, who know what they're doing, yeah, and know how to run an election, know what's going to matter. Like, one of my, you know, best friends in this game is Michael Tyler, who's helping to run things up there on More Than a Vote, which is how you see, you know, the level of strategy and the level of thoughtfulness and everything that they're doing. They have brought in folks that are really, really effective in this work, and it's going to pay dividends.
All right, so obviously LeBron doing great work there. He's also, most importantly, in the midst of a pretty important playoff series for the team that you root for. You had to balance all this last week. I'm imagining it's got to be, like, Democratic National Convention has to be the busiest week of your entire year. I would, maybe election week
this
itself.
Was the busiest week I've ever had in my entire life.
Bar none. And the Lakers and Blazers were battling it out every other night. There's no way you watched live, right? So how'd you do this? Were you DVRing and watching later? Were you, like, just checking text alerts? Like, how did this, like, how did you balance work and basketball?
I have two cell phones and a laptop. One of them is on the Laker game when the Laker game is on. We don't miss Laker games. That's in my contract, and we'll be going forward, is that Brandon Gassaway doesn't miss Laker games.
So you were able to kind of watch, were you in, like, I don't know, auditorium, whatever the room was there. Like, are you there in the same room when Biden's speaking, when Kamala's speaking, when whoever's speaking at that time?
So no, I was in Milwaukee, and we effectively created a bubble in Milwaukee where we were getting tested every day and you know, had to follow, like, very strict guidelines, masks. So it's very similar to what they're doing in the NBA. The NBA is really serving as a model for the whole country on how to actually beat this thing. So I was in Milwaukee on what we were calling NASA, because it's this room with hundreds of monitors where, like, that's where they were actually pulling the levers and pushing the buttons to make the thing run on time seamlessly. So I was there with my boss, Chair Tom Perez, you know, helping, you know, Joe Solomonis was the CEO, was overseeing the process, but we were there, you know, in a supportive role to help. We did a lot of press and media from there, and some of the, like, functional business that still actually had to get done, we were conducting there from Milwaukee. So I was there. Vice President Biden and Senator Harris gave their speeches from Delaware.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But it was just in front of reporters because, you know, we had consulted with health officials, and they said it was in, you know, everyone's best interest if we reduced the amount of people coming to the city as possible. And, you know, when President Biden, well, hopefully soon to be, but when Vice President Biden goes anywhere, there's a big footprint that goes with him of Secret Service and staff. And like, our number one goal, our guiding light in putting on this convention, was to make sure we keep the people of Milwaukee and all of our staff as safe as possible in the process. So that ended up being the best decision to that end.
Yeah. And it ended up being, I mean, listen, it is of the time, right? Like, we, no one's going to go into it expecting it to look like any other Democratic or for that matter, Republican. And it's not going to look like any convention that we've seen before. That's a given. Just like these NBA playoffs cannot and will not look like what we're used to. Then it becomes a matter of, but how well did you execute what you tried to do under the circumstances, simulating some of the traditions and the scenery and everything else? And it's still like it. Thought it came off pretty well. I'm actually wondering, like, if there's like some pieces of that where you guys think, oh man, we can involve more people and especially more citizens by doing some virtual in the future, in addition to hopefully being back to in person. It seems like there could be a hybrid down the road.
There are definitely elements that we discovered over the course of putting this unconventional convention together that we will take going forward. Like, there's a certain amount of utility of bringing us all together as a party every 4 years and kind of having that moment to be together and chart our path forward. But, you know, something like the roll call, what we did, and innovating around that, like where we got to see the entire country and sort of the, you know, the diversity and the idiosyncrasies within every state, that's something that could potentially be carried forward as, you know, a more permanent piece. And looking at things like that, we have an opportunity to really reimagine conventions in a way, to do them where we can involve a lot more people based on this experience we just had. So I definitely look forward to that in
yeah,
the future.
For sure. I don't think the NBA can possibly, I don't know, who knows? Maybe the NBA will still have like virtual fans mixed in amongst real fans in the future or something. But I'm not sure we can, I'm not sure there's any hybrid model for the NBA to discover in all this. The sooner they can get out of a bubble and back to normal arena atmosphere, the better, probably.
Yeah.
So LeBron, this is his second season with the Lakers, but first time in the playoffs. A lot at stake, because the second you introduce LeBron into a sentence, immediately there's a lot at stake. That's just, that goes with being LeBron James. But, you know, obviously all the obvious things here, his age and just the window. Tell me this. Coming from it, the political side of it, seeing everything LeBron's done, coming at it from the Kobe stan side of it, Laker fan who grew up on Kobe, and there was a time certainly for a lot of years where Kobe fans weren't necessarily all that enamored of LeBron. What has endeared him to you the most right now? The more than a vote and his political involvement, engagement, or the fact that he's got the Lakers seemingly on path, and things, you know, things look a little weird right now, but I still, you know, obviously I think they're going to beat the Blazers, but, you know, what does it take for him to make himself as near and dear to your heart? I don't want to say as Kobe, but to get himself in that top tier.
So before he passed, Kobe made it okay. Kobe made LeBron one of us. He ordained them into Laker Nation, and he is now one of us. And if you're a true Laker fan, This is the way we do it. We go and get Kareem. We go and get Shaq. We go and get Dwight Howard, even though that didn't work. we go and get LeBron. So when we do that, that is the Laker way, and that is how we've won historically. So when they put on the purple and the gold, they are ours. But, you know, there was some uniqueness to LeBron, because LeBron and Kobe were directly competing for the greatest player in the league crown for a long time. I still remember the NBA puppets very distinctly in my mind, and being very squarely in the Kobe side of that argument. And the rings argument was one I really leaned on very heavily. But, you know, if he wants to get two more and catch Kobe, I'd be okay with that.
I've often wondered, and I think it's different now. I think that this season changed a lot of things, obviously partially because of Kobe passing away. And but, it, you know, it was that same weekend, of course, that LeBron passes him on the scoring list. And that was at a time, you know, that putting Kobe on his sneakers and whatever, and all the messaging back and forth between them. I felt like it was, that to me was the first time that it finally melted away. Like, there was still, even when LeBron got there, even though Kobe kind of blessed it, I felt like there was still a distance between
them.
Was
that like his last tweet congratulating LeBron?
It might have been, yeah.
Passing him on the score. Like, he definitely worked to bring Laker Nation along in that, because, you know, some of those old habits
yeah.
die hard. And, you know, the work outside of basketball has been phenomenal and is really ramped up since he got to the Lakers. But from a basketball standpoint, you know, by midway last season, I had come on to the fact that, you know, LeBron's a Laker. If he wins rings in a Laker, he's going to, if he wins a championship as a Laker, his jersey's going up there with everyone else's. And that's a beautiful thing.
My very sportsy take, I think, at the time that he first signed was, well, that's fine, and you'll all automatically be one of the greatest Lakers of all time just by your body of work, but not in a Laker uniform. And Laker fans, having been spoiled over the decades by all these championships, they're not going to care that you're LeBron James, who won 4 MVPs in other places or won 3 championships in other places. It's still going to be, okay, but we're the Lakers. This is Laker. Like, you got to do for us. But I think that very sportsy take has kind of faded away, in part because of the almost very literal torch passing that we saw happen on that weekend. And then Kobe no longer being with us, Kobe having kind of, blessed LeBron's, Laker career, all these things. I feel like maybe we will treat this more sanely, that if LeBron falls short as a Laker, if he doesn't get the Lakers another title, if he doesn't get his 4th and or 5th, I don't think the standard is going to be anymore that he has to do what Kobe did or what Magic did or what Kareem did or anybody else did in a Laker uniform. I think what he's done to carry this team through this time, through this incredibly terrible and strange year, where he has them right now, and besides that, if he's not there, AD probably isn't either. Like, he's already done what he's done on various levels. And I will put the politics on it on top of it too. I think it cements him in a different way. I think that, you know, there will still always be people who are so caught up in rings culture that'll be the only way they judge his Laker tenure. But I feel like there's a breadth of work there that is both on and off the court that I think will be just weightier, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, he's transcended sports in a Laker uniform. He's really gone. The more than an athlete has really taken off since coming to LA. And I think that when we look at his career in totality, that's what's going to last the most and still have impact far beyond when he's, you know, had his last dunk and taken his last jump shot. So I think the legacy of the man, LeBron James, is still being written and is not yet defined. But as far as on the basketball court, man, I'm a Laker fan. I want to win. and that's the standard.
Of course.
You know, I can love you to death for all the things you do. But, you know, when they blow the whistle and they throw the ball up, like, we want to win. And as a Laker, you're expected to win. And I don't think we should have any 23s, or if he decides to give AD his jersey next year, number 3, or any of that in purple and gold until there's a championship that goes with it.
Which is fine. I would expect nothing less of a Laker fan. It's easy for me to go and intellectualize it as the, you know, reporter from the outside whose emotions are not cut up in whether or not they get another Larry O'Brien trophy. But yeah, it's bigger than basketball now. And yeah, of course, that is really, you know, the standards of the Laker organization and certainly of that fan base are so high. Anything less would be a disappointment. I think that maybe this new context will at least make it less of a blow if in fact he falls short, if that were to happen. I'm not saying he's going to, I'm just saying if that were to happen.
There will be no personal attacks on LeBron's character, but we will expect more of him next year. But I'm not even concerned with next year. The reports of our demise have been greatly exaggerated. We got to see playoff LeBron 2 nights ago. I anticipate him. We're doing this Monday. I anticipate to see playoff LeBron again tonight, close out this little series. What Dame has been doing has been cute. but it's big boy time now, and we're on a championship run.
And as an added bonus, you guys get to watch the upstart Clippers get smacked around by Luka, which I'm sure...
Oh, that was... So gratified. So Luka's a bad MF-er, man. Like, that guy. I actually have a funny story that I didn't know if I was going to tell, but
go for it.
Whatever. So we actually caught up at the All-Star game, which is the last NBA activity that I participated in person. But the last game I went to was when the Lakers went down to Dallas and Danny Green hit that game-winning shot. What's unique about me in that game is I have a really good friend from Dallas. His name's Reed. He has fantastic seats at the arena. It was my first time I ever sat courtside. And what I didn't realize is when you sit courtside, there's the court, and then like there's this lip and there's like cement under you. So like there's no cup holders, obviously, when you're for your beer. So I was putting it under me, but not under me on the cement, under me on the floor. So Alex Caruso comes off a screen, rises up and throws one down on Maxi Kleber. I jump up out of my seat in obvious, like, just exclamation, kick my beer from under me onto the floor. This is a nationally televised ESPN game. And I'm like, what am I going to? So I first, like, do I try to get it? But this is the floor of an NBA arena. I can't go out there. So the game stops. They put the camera on me on the Jumbotron. I'm in a Laker hat, obviously, in Dallas. The whole arena boos. But it speaks to his character and the his magnanimous nature. LeBron James picks up my empty beer can and hands it back to me.
Whoa.
It goes back to play.
Wow.
So I don't know if I'm going to be invited back. Reed, I'm sorry, but that was one of my more fun NBA moments.
That's phenomenal, phenomenal, mortifying and phenomenal at the same time. Like it's a great story you get to tell for decades to come. In the moment, I'm sure it was mortifying.
Yeah, it was tough. I've never had, you know, 40,000 people boo me before. It was an interesting experience.
That's just every day on Twitter for me. So that's just me versus Knicks fans. So LeBron doesn't know you though, right? Like you don't have any connection. At some point you will probably cross paths if he continues working with obviously voter registration and voter suppression and all those issues. Like it seems like inevitable you guys probably will cross paths. Are you going to tell him the story?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is by far my best LeBron story that I have. So I can't wait to. But the hope is that one day I will get to meet. I mean, actually, at the beginning of the year, before this all went down, convention was supposed to be in Fiserv. And the finals would have been a week before convention. So I would have been in Milwaukee for a hopeful, what I thought was going to be a Lakers-Bucks final. And be in the arena every day for the games, but that did not come to fruition.
Yeah, no, poor Milwaukee. The convention and possibly the finals there, everything like that. They really, that was certainly everybody there, and certainly the owners of the Bucks had that in mind for a while there.
They got
to double whammy from all this. All right, before I let you go, the last thing I wanted to just touch on real quickly here, if you don't mind. You got a couple more minutes? We good?
Yeah.
Okay. So the NBA, of course, goes to the bubble with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor as you know, in the very close rearview mirror. That had all just happened. There were still protests in the streets going on, this movement going on. All the players talking about, is this the right thing? We don't want to detract. So they go to the bubble with a very specific agenda on every front, basketball and social justice. And so, all right, Black Lives Matter is on the court. Every day we're watching playoff games, it's there on every court. The messages are still on the backs of their jerseys. The PSAs are in heavy rotation with players and coaches speaking out on these issues. The NBA is fully, fully engaged on this. And I think that there's still, to touch on something we touched on earlier in the discussion, but like there is a cynicism, I think, from some people who think this is just platitudes. This is, you know, maybe virtue signaling. I hate that phrase. This, you know, these are just statements. When George Floyd, when he was first murdered, the statements from teams on Twitter and otherwise, and people, again, they just, it was very easy to dismiss. All right, but what are you actually doing about it? And so I put it to you. I wonder your feelings on this as somebody who works in politics, who's also an NBA fan, who's also a Black man in America. You know, you're this, every vantage point of this, I think you've got, is it meaningful? does it matter? Is it making an impact? What's enough? What should we come to expect or hope for from the NBA on something on these issues?
I think everything they've done has been necessary. We're never going to get to enough. Racism isn't going away anytime soon. But the utility, the value that what the players are doing is, it makes one more person realize what's going on. Something that's happened since George Floyd is a lot of people woke up to realize that these things were happening. It's astonishing how many people simply just don't know these things exist and don't understand, you know, how it's different for someone like me to walk around a store, to drive around a neighborhood that, you know, folks might not think you belong in, or have an interaction with the police, how those things are different from me than someone who may have, you know, the same education, the same background I do, except that they're white. And educating more people to that brings more people around to working together to end those things. More people don't vote than vote. More people are not engaged than are engaged. So if we can increase, and all these things, all these elections, all these decisions, they are all made at the margins. It was 70,000 votes across 3 states that could have changed the election. The margins are very, very small. And every single thing we can do matters. If, you know, that 17-year-old who turns 18 in October realizes what systematic racism is and the impact of police brutality and what their vote in Michigan or in Pennsylvania means to starting to make progress on those issues, that is a tremendous victory for us. So, you know, some of these things, while they may be, you know, demonstrations rather than protest, or, you know, why is education reform on the back of your jersey or things like that? Like, I get those criticisms, but if those things help us bring in more people, it is invaluable, because the margins are so incredibly small and we need everyone we can get.
Yeah. No, amen to all of that. I agree. I think that, you know, for all the talk of it potentially turning people off or turning people away, it's only turning away the people who weren't going to be receptive to those messages anyway. Those weren't gettable votes or gettable supporters to change the issues that we're talking about. And it's all wrapped up together. I mean, it's exactly how you put it. I mean, and if we want to see the change that will prevent the next George Floyd, that still goes back to elections, and that still goes back to voting, and it still goes back to everybody being involved in whatever way they can be. So it all dovetails. I think it's all important. And, you know, it's easy to dismiss whatever the NBA's messaging has been if you don't buy it, or if you think that it's not enough. Like, I respect people who feel like, all right, but there has to be more. And then you're right, there should be more. And some of those teams have actually committed a lot of resources to a variety of causes. So I think there's you know, always more to be done. But personally, I'd like to think that this is encouraging. That we're seeing something real.
It is good. And I think, I mean, you've done, I'm a fan in addition, you know, to being a guest here on the pod. You had an episode with Spears not too long ago where you went into those things specifically that the league can do. And it's not an either or, it's an and. You know, you can do these things here, it's great, it's helpful on this level, but here are some other things you can do as a league, you know, multi-billion dollar league, in terms of, like, what does your C-suite look like? What kind of vendors are you using? Those are definitely changes that can be and need to be made, but I don't want to discount the things that may be smaller and more symbolic. Those things have impact too.
Yeah, absolutely. Brandon, this has been fantastic, man. I'm so glad we got a chance to do this. I know it's a very, very busy time for you. I love that we ended up doing this. This was not planned necessarily, folks, this way. Brandon and I were talking about doing this. It just happened to fall on Kobe Day. It's amazing that it did.
It's why, I mean, it feels like it was meant to be.
It feels like it was meant to be. I'd like to think maybe Kobe kind of pushed this all together or orchestrated a little bit. So thanks, Brandon. Good luck with the campaign and everything else. Good luck to your Lakers, although I am nonpartisan when it comes to that. And if anybody, by the way, speaking of partisanship, if anybody from the RNC is a huge NBA fan and wants to come on and talk, you know, Republican politics and NBA intersection, if there is such a thing still, feel free. I'm equal opportunity. I imagine that would be a very much different discussion. But
probably Celtics fans.
Listen, now you've thrown it down. Now we're going to be both hearing from all the Celtics fans.
Hey, I can handle that.
If you want to yell at him, he's Kobe Stan on Twitter. So
yeah, that's me,
Brandon. This has been great, man. Thanks again.
All right, thank you. This is a pleasure.